for myself, and although he protested, I bought for my husband a dhoti, which he badly needed, since the other was in rags and barely covered his loins. Both he and I had the garments we wore at our daughter's marriage, but these we never thought of wearing. Whatever hardships our day-to-day living might have, we were determined not to disgrace our sons on the days of their weddings. Chapter 10. Deep Valley. The Festival of Lights approached. It is a festival mainly for the children, but of course everyone who can takes part. I twisted cotton into wicks, soaked them in oil, and placed them in mud saucers, ready to be lit at night. To the children, I handed out 2 annas apiece, to be spent on fireworks. I had never even been able to do so before. In previous years, we had contented ourselves with watching over people's fireworks, or with going down to the bonfire in the village. And even now, I felt qualms about raising money on such quickly spent pleasures. But their rapturous faces overcame my misgivings. It is only once, I thought, a memory. As it grew dark, we lit the tapers and wicks and encircled our dwelling with light. A feathery breeze was stirring, setting the flames leaping and dancing, the reflections in the black glistening oil cavorting too. In the town and in the houses nearby, hundreds of small beacons were beginning to flash now. And then a rocket would tear into the sky, break and pour out its riches like precious jewels into the darkness. As the night went on, the crackle and spit of exploding fireworks increased. The children had bought boxes of colored matches and strings of patas and a few pice worth of crackers, like small nuts, which split in two with a loud bang amidst a shower of sparks when lit. The last were the most popular. The boys pranced around shrieking with laughter and throwing the crackers about everywhere. Yet they were nimble enough to skip out of harm's way. All except Selvam, the youngest. He stood a safe distance away, legs apart and obviously ready to run, holding a stick of sugar cane nearly as tall as himself, which he had brought instead of fireworks. "Go and play," I said to him. "Deep Valley comes but once a year, and this is the first time we have bought fireworks. Do not lose this opportunity." "I am afraid," he said frankly, his small face serious. After we had eaten, and rather well, there were no crackers left, and the oil in the saucers had run dry. We walked to the town. Selvam refused to come. He was a stubborn child. I knew it was useless to try to persuade him. Ira stayed behind too, saying she preferred to stay with him. I think she was glad of the excuse he provided, for since her return she had not cared to be seen about. And of course there would be a large crowd in the town. Villagers from all around, like us, were converging toward the bonfire to be lit there. Already smoke wisps were curling toward the clouds. Torches were beginning to flare. The smell of oil was everywhere, heavy and pungent, exciting the senses. Our steps quickened, quicker and quicker, greedy, wanting to encompass everything, to miss not one iota of pleasure. Then, as happens even in the brightest moment, I remembered Janaki. Last year she had come with us, she and her children. This year, who knew, or cared? The black thought momentarily doused the glow within me. Then, angered and indignant, I threw the intruder away, chasing it, banishing it, tired of gloom, reaching desperately for perfection of delight, which can surely never be. There was a great noise everywhere. Men, women, and children from the tannery and the fields had come out, many of them in new clothes such as we too had donned, the girls and their women with flowers in their hair and glass bangles at their wrists and silver rings on their toes, and those who could afford it wore silver golsu clasped around their ankles and studded belts around their waists. In the center of the town, the bonfire was beginning to smolder. For many weeks, the children had been collecting firewood, rags, leaves, and brushwood. And the result was a huge pile like an enormous anthill, into which the flames ate fiercely, hissing and crackling and rearing up as they fed on the bits of camphor and oil-soaked rags that people threw in. In the throng, I lost Nathan and the boys, or perhaps they lost me. At any rate, we got separated. I pushed my way through the crush, this and way and that, nobody giving an inch, in my efforts to find them, and in the end, I had to give up. But before long, in the heat and excitement, I forgot them. Drums had begun to beat. The fire was blazing fiercely. great long orange tongues consumed the fuel and thrusting upwards and sometimes outwards as if to engulf the watchers. As each searching flame licked around, the crowd leaned away from its grasp, straightening as the wind and the flames changed direction, so that there was a constant swaying movement like the waves of river grasses. The heat was intense. Faces gleamed ruddy in the firelight. One or two women had drawn their saris across their eyes. Leaping, roaring to climax, then the strength taken from a fury, a quieting. Slowly, one by one, the flames gave up their color and dropped, until at last there were none left, only a glowing heap, ashen-edged. The drumbeats died to a murmur. The scent of jasmine flowers mingled with the fumes of camphor and oil, and a new smell, that of toddy, which several of the men had been drinking, many to excess, for they were lurching about loud-mouthed and more than ordinarily merry. I looked about for my family, and at last saw my husband. He seemed to have gone mad. He had one son seated on his shoulders and one son at each hip, and was bounding about on the fringes of the crowd to the peril of my children and the amusement of the people. I fought my way to him. "Have you taken leave of your senses?" I cried out above the din. "No, only of my cares," he shouted gaily, capering about with the children clinging delightedly to him. "Do you not feel the joy in the air?" He sounded so light of heart I could not help smiling. "I feel nothing," I said, going up to him. "Perhaps it is the toddy that makes the feeling." "Not a drop," he said, coming to me. "Smell." "You are too tall. I cannot," I replied. "Lift her up," somebody yelled, and a dozen voices repeated the cry. "Lift her up. Lift her up." My husband looked at me solemnly. "I will," he said, and dropping his sons, he seized me and swung me up high in front of all those people. Several of the women were laughing at him indulgently. The children were twittering with pleasure. "Whatever will they say?" I said, my face burning as he let me down. "At our age, too, you ought to be ashamed." "That I am not," he said, winking to the vast delight of the onlookers. "I am happy because life is good and the children are good and you are the best of all." What more could I say after that? Nathan sang loudly all the way back. He was in high spirits. The children, tired out, clumped along in silence, the youngest with frequent pleas to be carried. And when we took no notice, he began snuffling. It was a very hot night. Selvam and Ira were sleeping out in the open. In the small square in front of our hut, which I had swept and washed with the dung that morning. The others stretched themselves out and were asleep almost as they lay down. Nathan had lost none of his good humor. He seemed very wide awake. I stretched myself out beside him, close to him in the darkness, and as we touched, he turned abruptly towards me. Words died away. The listening air was very still. The black night waited. In the straining darkness, I felt his body moving with desire. His hands on me were trembling, and I felt my senses opening like a flower to his urgency. I closed my eyes and waited. Waited in the darkness while my being filled with a wild, ecstatic fluttering, waiting for him to come to me. Chapter 11. One of my husband's male relatives had died, and he had to attend the funeral. When he had gone, I took the opportunity of going to see Kenny. I had not done so before because I was sure that Nathan would not like his wife or his daughter going to a white man, a foreigner. My father had been different, but Nathan, I felt, would not approve. And if he did not, the one chance Ira had would be lost, and this made it the more important that he should not know. I explained this to Ira cautiously, and she nodded listlessly and said yes. It was a necessary precaution, but she did not look at me, and she showed no enthusiasm. I was getting more and more worried about her. She moped about, dull of hair and eye, as if the sweetness of life had departed, as indeed it had for a woman who was abandoned by her husband. Kenny was working in the small building they had put up near the tannery. I could see him whenever the door opened to let someone out. There was a long line of men waiting. I squatted some distance away. The day wore on, the sun had set, the glow of twilight was touched with darkness before he came out. He looked grim and tired, for his eyes were burning, There was an air of such impersonal cruelty about him that despite myself, I shivered. "No more tonight," he said briefly to the assembled men, and stepping down from the vendaja, he strode away. I waited till the crowd dispersed, then I followed. He was walking quickly with long strides. I had to catch up to him. He stopped at last when he heard my footsteps and waited for me to come up, frowning so that I began to feel afraid. I said, "No more tonight. Did you not hear me? Do you think I am made of iron?" "I waited all day," I gasped. "I must see you. My husband will be back soon, and then I cannot come." His frown deepened. He said coldly, "You people will never learn. It is pitiful to see your foolishness." "It is for my daughter I come," I said. "She cannot bear. She is as I was." "You will be a mother even before she is," he replied with a glimmer of a smile, "for it seems you have no difficulty." "It is so," I said. "I would it were otherwise, and she in my condition, for she is much afflicted since her husband has no use for her." "Why did she not come then?" he said. "Since it is her need, it would have been much more sensible." There was an edge to his voice, and his mouth twisted as if in exasperation. "Forgive me," I whispered, quaking. "I was not sure." To my surprise, he put both hands on my shoulders, forcing me to look at him, and I saw he was laughing. "I am sorry I frightened you," he said. "You should not act like a timid calf at your age. As for your daughter, I will do what I can. But remember, no promises." He turned and was gone. I sat down to think and to collect my wits. When at last I rose to go, a full moon was shining, golden and enormous, very low in the sky. Bats went swooping silently by. I kept to the narrow footpath, clear and white in the moonlight, walking swiftly and absorbed in my thoughts. I heard no footsteps, only a voice calling my name from the shadows. I stopped, my heart hitting out wildly at my breast, and then I saw it was Kunti, standing where the path forked with the moonlight streaming down on her. "You startled me," I said. "I did not expect." "That I can see," she said coolly, coming towards me. "You keep late hours, Rukmani." "No later than yours," I replied, not liking her tone. "I have my reasons." "Of course," she said softly, decision in her voice. "We all have reasons." "Mine are not the same as yours," I said with contempt, surveying her. She came very close, so close that I smelt the rose petals in her hair, saw the paint on her mouth. "Meaning?" "That we live differently. It is charitable to say no more. Let me pass." She stood squarely in my path. "I would not have thought it," she said slowly, "had I not seen it for myself." "Thought what?" I said. "Seen what?" "That you have so much passion in your body," she said insolently, "that you seek assuagement thus. Your husband would give much to know where you have been tonight." I saw her mouth forming these words, her eyes half hooded and mocking. Then I saw her face suddenly close to mine, and I did not realize I had thrown myself at her until I felt her body in my grip. An overwhelming rage possessed me. I kept shaking her furiously. I could not stop. Her slender body was no match for mine. I saw her head fall back. The thin sari she wore slipped from her shoulders. Then I saw that it was not tied at the waist, but below the navel, like a strumpet's, and that she was naked below. Sandalwood paste smeared her swelling hips. Under the breasts were dark painted shadows, which gave them sensuous depth. The nipples were tipped with red. I released her. She stood there before me, panting, with her hair shaken loose and coiling about her shoulders. "Guard your tongue," I said, "or it will be worse for you." She said nothing for a moment while she rearranged her garments, recovering herself a little. Then once again, that maddening, insulting half-smile curved her lips. "And for you," she said, with knives in her voice, "and for your precious husband." With that, she was gone. I went alone to summon my daughter's husband. "Take her back," I said. "There is nothing wrong with her now. She will bear you many sons yet." "I would," he replied with a hint of sorrow in his eyes, "but she was a good wife to me, and a comely one. But I have waited long, and now I have taken another woman." I went away. Ira was waiting, eagerness shining from her. "You must not blame him," I said. "He has taken another woman." She said not a word. I repeated what I had said, for she seemed to not understand, but she only looked at me with stony eyes. Thereafter, her ways became even more strange. She spent long hours out in the country by herself, spoke little, withdrew completely into herself, and went about her tasks with a chill hopelessness that daunted me. No one could see in her now the warm, lovely creature she had been, especially sometimes when Selvin came to her, perching on her lap and coaxing a smile from her, for she had always had a special love for him. As my pregnancy advanced, she turned completely away from me. Sometimes I saw her looking at me with brooding, resentful eyes, and despite myself, I could not help wondering if hatred lay behind her glance. Then, at last, my child was born. A nicely formed boy, smaller than the others had been, but of course I was older now. We named him Kuti, which means tiny, and being a happy, troublesome baby, everybody took pleasure in his arrival. None more so than Ira. The transformation in her was as astonishing as it was inexplicable. I had feared she might dislike the child, but now it was as if it were her own. She lost her dreary air. Her face became animated. The bloom of youth came back to her. "Our daughter is herself again," said Nathan to me. "I have heard her caroling like a bird." "She is happy with the child," I replied, "but I do not know what is to become of her in the future." "Again worrying," he chided. "It is merciful that she is young again. Should not one be grateful?" He was a man and did not understand. How could I stop worrying? We had no money to leave her. Who would look after her when we were gone and the boys were married with families of their own? With a dowry, it was perhaps possible she might marry again. Without it, no man would look at her, no longer a virgin and reputedly barren. No one had been more upset about the outcome of Ira's marriage than old Granny. It was she who had arranged the match, and though failing in health, she thought it her duty to come to me. She had aged considerably since the last time I had seen her. She walked slowly, pausing before each step to gather strength for the next. Her hands kept up a slight shuddering movement like a nervous flutter of a bee or a flower. "No fault of yours, or the girl's, or her husband's," I told her. "It is fate. Nevertheless, I do not like to think of the future." "Why fear?" said the old lady. "Am I not alone, and do I not manage?" I thought of her sitting in the street all day long, with the gunny sacking in front of her, piled with a few of Anna's worth of nuts and vegetables, and I thought of Ira doing the same thing, and I was silent. "It is not unbearable," she said, watching me with her shrewd eyes. "One gets used to it." "It is true. One gets used to anything. I had got used to the noise and the smell of the tannery. They no longer affected me. I had seen the slow, calm beauty of our village wilt in the blast from town, and I grieved no more. So now I accepted the future and Ira's lot in it, and thrust it from me. Only sometimes when I was weak, or in sleep while my will lay dormant, I found myself rebellious, protesting, rejecting, and no longer calm. Chapter 12. One day in each week, when the tannery stopped work, Arjun and Tambi would help their father on the land, and this gave Nathan great pleasure. He liked to see his sons beside him, to teach them the ways of the earth, how to sow, to transplant, to reap, to know the wholesome from the rotten, the unwelcome reed from the paddy, and how to irrigate or drain the terraces. In all these matters, he had no master, and I think it helped him to know he could impart knowledge to his sons. More skilled, though, they were in other things, and able to read and write better than any in the town. The rest of the week, they worked at the tannery, going there soon after daybreak and not coming back until it was dark. By the time they had entered their late teens, they were earning good wages, a rupee for each day's work. And without fail, they would hand me their earnings, keeping nothing back for gaming or whoring, as many of the lads did. Each morning I cooked rice for them, sometimes dal or vegetables as well, which they took with them to eat midday. And when they came home, I gave them rice water and dried fish, sometimes a little buttermilk or perhaps a few plantains I had kept from selling. But from what they gave me, I had also to buy clothes for them, for they were expected to put on shirts over their loincloths and red turbans on their heads, so that although we had full bellies and were well clothed, there was not much left over, and the hope I secretly cherished of putting by some of my money for Ira soon withered. and when it finally died, I recovered my peace of mind and was happy enough. If there was nothing to be done in the fields,